Well, I hope you are as happy about it being Friday as I am.
Woohoo!
As it is now 5 p.m. It is official. The weekend is on us. It felt like it took about 6 months to get here.
It's the happy, happy hour.
It sure is. Hi, everybody, and welcome to American Hit Radio, coming to you from WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, here every Wednesday and Friday at 5 with me. Thank goodness for me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales, Ryan. Holding things together. If you are a regular listener, you know that on Fridays, we change the format of our show just a tiny bit to what we call How Music Changed, where we focus on very specific events that are among the most influential aspects of music culture from the past century of American history. We vary from very old to the reasonably recent, and we are right now on a topic which is among the very old. We started this a couple weeks ago. I was unable to get in last week because I was ill. I apologize for that. So we are live again. I promise you that. And 2 weeks ago when we started this, it was actually part 15 where we covered what I was calling, for lack of a better title, because it goes on and on and on, piano from blues to boogie-woogie to big band. And with a good healthy dose of stride in there as well. Basically, what I was trying to do, and I think I made my point in the very first show, that piano is probably the single most influential instrument of the 20th century, even above and beyond the guitar, because it was the piano that was at the forefront of helping to popularize the music that became jazz. And in our first show, as we covered how the music eventually landed itself in Harlem, where it was eventually known as Harlem Stride or Stride Piano Music, what was happening there. And there were a certain number of players, purveyors you could call them, who were very important to developing the music there. As we ended our show, we introduced one character who was pretty much the preeminent person for doing this distribution of the music, you could say, as I was talking about. That person being none other than Fats Waller. Now, we covered, like I said, a couple of songs of Fats. And I think the most important thing to remember about Fats, or to basically reiterate from what we had covered last week, is that one of the major players up in Harlem was James P. Johnson. Definitely one of the most talented players. Had a few years on Fats, but he loved Fats, took Fats under his wing. And you can understand why once you get to know Fats and his music, as
well,
I hope.
Because he got such an early start, it's somebody older had to take him under his wing.
Oh, yeah, exactly, because he wasn't even 20 by the time he got things rolling. But Fats is such an ebullient character. First of all, flat out, he's incredibly talented. So there was no problem with that. The guy wasn't faking anything. He really did have a tremendous ability on the piano. Mm-hmm. But he also had a very unique personality. He was able Exactly. So all of these things really added to his appeal. So while the other guys who were doing the Harlem Stride sort of thing, most of them were just players, as Fats was in the beginning, Fats was able to incorporate his personality as time went by, which is one of the major reasons why he became one of the single most important players on the scene. Now, we're going to start really early as we cover Fats' music. We're going to go all the way back to 1928, in fact, for the very first recording that we're going to play by him, right? Very early.
Yeah.
Around this time, he was writing Broadway shows. There was a show called Keep Shufflin' that he was responsible for writing with that time. And actually, he was in the orchestra pit with James P. Johnson. If you had
and
gone,
this is after he had already been doing like the movie theater work and stuff like that, right?
It's around that. Well, this is, yes, exactly. I'm sorry. Yeah, when he was working as a teenager doing background for the silent movies and stuff like that. You're exactly right. Because now he's to the point where now he's on Broadway.
Okay.
And he's in the pits with James P. Johnson. And I mean in the orchestra pit.
I see.
With James P. Johnson. And they're writing their own material and it's very popular. And what's really cool about this is, I mean, if you were going to see a show, this show on Broadway, you would actually have seen two piano players facing each other in the pit playing back and forth to one another. James P. Johnson on one piano, Fats Waller on the other.
Oh, wow.
And they were both responsible for a lot of the songs that they were writing. Now, when they got into the recording studio, and I'm glad you brought it up, Heidi, about the work that Fats did in the movie theaters, because what Fats also did in the movie theaters, I think I had mentioned at the time, was that he would play organ between the movies.
Right.
Well, now they went into the recording studio, they figured it would be a good idea to let Fats play the organ and let James P. Johnson stay on the piano. So what you're going to hear on this track then is James P. Johnson playing the piano with Fats Waller actually playing organ, pipe organ, in a recording studio in Camden, New Jersey, with a couple of horn players to back them up, with a style which is very, very indicative of what early Stride was sounding like, a song simply called Sippy. One thing that's worth pointing out, I mean, that song sounds so old school fashioned, you know,
Barry.
With Fats Organ on that. But it's important to remember, I mean, that the center of the recording industry pretty much was still very solidly based in New York. The major labels were there. So that's why it was so important that jazz made the transition as it did, coming up from New Orleans to Chicago and eventually coming to New York. Although, of course, there were places to record in around Chicago, and thank goodness for that, because that's where Louis Armstrong's earliest sides were recorded, you know, within a six or seven hour drive's radius of Chicago anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But when the music began to come to New York and Harlem, well, pop music was already existing and thriving in New York. We've done earlier shows, as I had said, you know, this is going to bring into play all of those various factors of our other earlier shows that we had done, because the music business itself existing here, the original Columbia Records and things like that,
mm-hmm.
were basically trying to find product to sell. It was a business, and they really weren't worried about trying to distribute art at all.
I guess it was working to sell the Edison's original idea was that it was going to be like an office thing to take
stenography.
Yes,
and
stenography.
Such. Exactly.
So
but
they could dictate to your secretary.
They did quick catch on, though, that that recording device was working excellent for music, especially certain instruments translated perfectly to it. And that the human voice was doing fine, piano accompanied.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the pop music scene was at the time. So by the time the jazz got to New York, it was just something else to record. they were really looking for pop artists. So it would just be a matter of time before Fats Waller was able to more or less merge jazz with pop music, which was, it was inevitable. But at this point in time specifically, I'd like to cover before I get to that point, where he is actually recording some of his own piano compositions, just him on the piano. Now, I guess I want to play these just to prove exactly where he is coming from and what his own talent is, because this is, like I said, this is Fats alone. Fats Waller, mm-hmm. by himself, compositions that he had written, and you even get a bit of a sense of humor in the title of the song, because he's calling this first track Numb Fumbling. Like, my fingers don't know what I'm doing. That's obviously not true when you hear the song. That's just one rather brilliant example of not only how talented he is as a player, but of his innovative writing. You know, you can hear that song now. Here it is. That song is 80 years old, over 80 years old, and it still sounds like fresh and fun. And, you know, it's a nice song to hear when it comes on. And in fact, I've got another that I'd like to play of him, basically ripping through changes. Now, there's an interesting thing that I wanted to find in here, and I wonder if I could find it right away. It was essentially a definition of what stride piano is. And it's kind of nice because to put it in perspective, it's kind of like, it just mentions, here we go. I'll just read this right out of the booklet that comes with the Fats Domino album.
No, it's not Fats Domino.
There I go. I keep doing that. I did that last.
Wrong Fats.
I'm such a rock and roller. Pardon me for that. You'll have to keep doing that to me because I'm sure that it just it's the more nuanced. Anyway,
Fats Waller.
Speaking of Fats Waller, okay, and actually of stride piano in general, the definition of it. The best definition of stride by far, according to this book, comes from the gifted pen of the latter-day master of the idiom, Dick Wellstud. Condensed somewhat for this occasion, but relating it with his characteristic wit, Having stated his dislike for musical labeling, he says that Stride is a sort of ragtime, looser than Joplin's classic rag, but sharing its march-like structures and oompah bass, but warns against too much emphasis on the latter. Conventional wisdom has it that Stride is largely a matter of playing a heavy oompah in the left hand, but conventional wisdom is mistaken, as usual. Stride playing requires a certain characteristic rhythmic articulation to be found in the work of U.B. Blake and James P. Johnson and Fats Waller, among others. The feel of Stride is kind of like a soft shoe, 12-8, rather than the 8-8 of ragtime. And although the left hand plays oompahs, the total feeling is frequently an accented 4-beat, rather than the 2-beat you might expect, which gets us back to what we were, again, saying in our first show. If this is a matter of feel. If you didn't have the feel, then you weren't going to be able to play this type of music anymore. It wasn't didn't matter that it wouldn't be written down, because this was all about what the player brought to the table. And this is exactly what Fats Waller, said it right that time, was achieving with his own compositions, like on this song called Smashing Thirds. Now that's called Smashing Thirds, but I don't think I could find a better example of on the planet of a song that better emphasizes the growth and the change of how ragtime was developing and turning into something very different than what ragtime was. The strict feel, as I had read in that little passage earlier, the strict time of a ragtime feel, which is probably would have been very even tempo, da 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 da, you know, very 16th notes, really.
Right.
All of a sudden, now it's got a bounce to it. It's got a swing. And the thing that he's doing with his left hand there, as opposed to going boom, da, boom, da, like you would in a rag, he's like a boom, da, da, boom, da, boom, da, boom, ba. And it's that tight bounce that gives it a swing. that plus the triplet feel. And you put those things together, and all of a sudden you got something which is very different from what it was. And it is now more or less conveying, really it's a piano player trying to convey what everything that would have been done by an orchestra in a very simple sense. And that's what Fats is doing beautifully on that track. Now let's catch up on some of his history a little bit before we get to the next song, because at this early part of his career, there are really very few recordings. It just wasn't very easy. I think I'd mentioned that as well, that it wasn't easy for them to get into the recording studio. Even in New York, pre-1930, it was just not the most common thing. You'd have to go truck to Camden, New Jersey, and what was the point, especially if you didn't have like a big major recording label that was going to be publishing your stuff anyway.
Right.
So, and he was mostly interested in what was happening on Broadway. So besides the earlier show, Keep Shuffling, that he had been in with James P. Johnson, his first huge success actually came with a musical called Connie's Hot Chocolates. And it took its name because there was a place up in Harlem called Connie's Inn, which is hugely popular up in Harlem. It was like one of the biggest night spots in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And so
like a cotton club type place or something like that?
Yeah, predating that even. So this was sort of like a real central point. Gangster owned, of course, as most of that stuff was. But Fats had decided to write music based around that scene, but brought it down to Broadway so that it wouldn't be quite, basically to make it easier for people to see what was going on. You know, go to the theater instead of going to the nightclub, where it might have been mm-hmm. a little bit rough for certain people, or for mixed crowds, or women for that matter.
Or, yeah, and women who were prudish about going into a club.
Exactly. So all of a sudden, Fats Waller, by dint of his trying to basically popularize what the scene was that he was at, has a way of basically, again, spreading the music in a very popular way. And this was actually, from when we were covering Louis Armstrong, very smart guy. And who does he get on to play trumpet in the pit band for his show? Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong was the show featured the song "Ain't Misbehavin'," and this was it was Louis Armstrong who broke the song for
right.
Fats Waller when this was all going on. So now Fats is obviously sort of reveling in a certain degree of fame, and he has huge respect from somebody like Louis Armstrong. So, and I'm sure it was vice versa as well. So things are going well. Problem is, Fats has got a couple of issues that are working against him. One is the fact that when he was very young working in the theaters, he had met a woman that he fell in love with and got married to her at a very young age, and the marriage went south very quickly.
Oops.
And so now he's paying alimony payments, and he's having all sorts of marital troubles and money troubles, actually, basically trying to basically pay his way out of that, the problems that he had for getting married so young. He also tends to drink. He was one of the, they said that he'd be the type of guy. There was a story where Fats would walk into a recording session on a Sunday morning and just say with him, "You must have some juice around here for me, right?" And they're like, "No, what is it? Sunday morning." And he's like, "Oh, we've got to find something." And sure enough, I mean, he wouldn't start until they were able to procure a bottle. And then he would literally take the bottle, drink the entire fifth of whiskey.
Yikes.
The entire bottle. And then play flawlessly.
Wow.
He was one. He was really. He was quite. He was not called Fats Waller. Everything that he did was to excess.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. And so it has a lot to do with why he died so young. I mean, he just barely made it into to his 40th year.
Oh my goodness!
So he's living way too fast. But these things with his alimony payments and his drinking and everything else, he realized with his money problems that he had to. Sometimes he needed money too fast. So in one instance, what he did was he took all of the publishing that he was making from Connie's Hot Chocolates, including Ain't Misbehavin', sold it all off to Irving Mills Publishing. So he was making no money off of it because he wanted to make the fast buck.
Yeah.
So he was actually, he was doing this all the time because he said, "It doesn't matter, I can write 20 more." And he would. Then he'd go back and he would just keep writing. He was able to compile hundreds of songs. They just kept cuffing at him. So he figured that the well would never run dry. It didn't matter to him if he sold them and gave them away. So he was also among one of the very first of the musicians, especially in the New York area, to integrate his band. We're talking about 1929, 1930. And he's playing with guys like Eddie Condon and Jack Teagarden in his band.
Wow.
He's calling himself Fats Waller and his buddies. And these guys were doing gigs like this. And by 1930, he was actually hosting his very own radio show in New York. And by 1931, this is when he started recording in earnest for Columbia Records, and he started to feature vocals on some of these tracks. By 1932, his radio show went national which was a really big deal. Fats Waller's Rhythm Club was the name of the show. It aired twice a week. It featured his own band, of course, and then he'd bring in a vocal group. He had his own vocal group that would perform on the show, and of course, special guests would come on. It was like a radio variety show.
Stunning.
It was a huge success, which eventually led to a tour of U.S. theaters. Soon, of course, because he's performing live and he's going to all these theaters, his personality and his banter were beginning to rival his reputation as a piano player and a songwriter. He was becoming
That's
the first,
not a bad thing.
Absolutely not. He was becoming the first class showman that everybody got to know him as. And it was because of this, eventually, that RCA decided that they wanted to woo him away from the very few records that he was that Columbia was granting him to record. So finally, it was around 1934 that his recording career really began to blossom in earnest. And that's exactly where this next track comes from one of his RCA recordings in 1930. Here he is, only 30 years old, and I think you're going to see this is where it all begins to come together. You're going to hear him singing, his voice, his personality, and this is pretty much the Fats that began to go forward as becoming one of the most important musical arbiters or characters in the history of jazz. With this track, one example anyway, called How Can You Face Me?
Woman, have you no conscience? How could you be so bold? Why have you grown so cold after the lies you've told? No one now seems to be on the level. Since I found that my angel was just a dog known as the devil, why does I love you, huh? Why did you teach me how? After you broke each vow, how can you face me now? Dirty dog, get out in the street, get out, get out. How can you face me now? No, I didn't go there last night. No, you know I wasn't there neither. I went to another place. Yes! Don't you talk back to me, shut up! Take your dogs on out in the street.
Pretty much all you need to know about Fats right there in that track. Everything about his personality comes out. He was the master of the aside. He was so like unafraid of playing with his own lyrics and having fun with them,
mm-hmm.
that it was contagious. It was so easy to love his music. And in the meantime, his piano playing is developing like just in literally in strides, no pun intended. But I mean, in fact, I want to play one more solo piano track before we move on to more of his vocal pieces, because this is sort of a brilliant, just an amazingly brilliant piece of work. I had mentioned earlier that James P. Johnson had written a song called Carolina Shout that became sort of the showpiece. If you were going to play stride piano, this is the song that you had to master. And if you didn't play this
to really, prove your chops.
Exactly. You know, basically, you You sat down and you had to not only play it well, but you had to pretty much bring your own thing to it, mm-hmm. or else you would just, you'd get cut. You know, you'd just get totally cut. So it was this testing piece that had existed for years and years and years for different players. And here, a later recording that I'm playing out of sequence because it sort of fits into the earlier time period, is Fats doing what probably has become the definitive version of this song. Truly remarkable. Fats Domino performing his version of James
Not
P.
Not Domino, huh?
Ah, Waller. So glad you're here. I'm so glad you're here. Thank goodness for that. Performing his version of James P. Johnson's, got that name right, Carolina Shout. Of course, I'm playing all of these piano pieces because this is where the emphasis is lying for what the series is about, of course.
Yes.
But of course, we know that Fats Waller is about so much more than that. Now, he calls his band Fats Waller and His Rhythm. It's that simple.
Oh, I thought you said it was his buddies.
Well, that was earlier. But now, like when he's with RCA, most of the recordings that he was putting out, he went under the name of Fats Waller and His Rhythm. And this is like so typical of him. Now, he gets the recording contract with RCA, and he knows he's got to go into the studio to record. And he doesn't have a band yet. He just waits till like 2 days before the recording session, and then he starts like basically gathering up a couple of friends. And it's, you know, he basically, again, according to the book, with characteristic panache, Fats waited until just a few days before he was due to report at RCA Studios 2 in Manhattan with five musicians to round up a likely bunch of characters. The only musician he definitely had in mind was 19-year-old Al Casey, who was a 19-year-old who had been babysitting his sons. And it's kind of funny because he's the guy that ended up basically staying. He was one of the mainstays of the band. And this next track is actually Fats Waller and His Rhythm on a song that was not written by Fats. Actually, they're just doing a cover version of it. But the members of the band, this is a rather early incarnation of them, but Al Casey very much there on guitar. Herman Autry on trumpet. Rudy Powell on clarinet and alto sax here. Harry Dial on drums. And, of course, the inimitable Thomas Fats Waller on piano. performing a cover of a song that, through some reason, it's hard to say why, but this is the way that pop music worked back then. This became the biggest hit of his entire career. Everybody believes that he wrote this, I think, because of the fact. But actually, it's not the case. It was written by Fred Allert and Joe Young. The song is called "I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter." That's a relatively straight reading by Fats Waller on that track, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't play with it very much at all. It's almost, I don't want to say that it's an ordinary recording because he's so talented, but it's unusual that I guess it goes to show you that, you know, the fickle tastes of the music buying public or whatever, or maybe that's
or the recording industry
in general, or maybe that's just what people were able to like really, what's the word, ingest at that time without having it become seeming too crazy, because by him reading it straight, it ended up having a very broad appeal, and that was the biggest hit that he had in his lifetime. But this next track, I think, is also Fats Waller doing an interpretation of somebody else's song. It's a song called Christopher Columbus. It was actually originally recorded by Fletcher Henderson's band.
Oh, wow.
And his partner, Andy Razoff, who was doing a lot of the writing with him, helping him with some of his words, had added words to the song. And so Fats does a cover of it. And here you're basically going to get what Fats really is capable of doing. I mean, this song is just it swings. It's funny. It's perfect. It's I guess a perfect example of what Fats is about. Check this out now. I mean, now we're really talking about what the man is capable of. This song called Christopher Columbus. I'll show you what it's about.
Christopher Columbus sailed the sea without a compass. When his men began a rumpus, up spoke Christopher Columbus, yes.
There's land somewhere until we get there. We will not go wrong if we sing, swing a song.
Since the world is round, oh, we'll be safe and sound, oh. Till our goal is found, oh, we'll just keep rhythm bound, oh.
Since the crew was making merry, Mary got up and went home. Then came a yell for Isabel, and they brought on the rum and Isabel. No more mutiny, no. What a time at sea. With diplomacy, Christy made history, yes. Mr. Christopher Columbus, uh-huh. He used rhythm as a compass, yes, yes. Music ended all the rumpus, yes. Wise old Christopher Columbus. Latch on, Christy, yes. Yes, yes, yes. In the year 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. What I say?
That's pretty funny.
Incredible. They could just have that much fun, you know? And it's not, you know, somebody else's words, somebody else's material, but he's just all over it. It's fantastic. Now, this next track I'm going to play, though, is actually his own composition. And it just goes to show you just, you know, how he's developing again and where he really comes from. What's great about this is here on this track, he actually takes the role of the person, I guess, who's in charge of the hotel at large that he's talking about. It's called Lounging at the Waldorf.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the host. And as he's taking you through the hotel while the band is playing in the background. And his commentary is absolutely priceless. This is brilliant. It's his own composition. Probably one of the best things the man has ever recorded. I love this track by Fats Waller called Lounging at the Waldorf.
Very, very good. Mrs. Throckmorton, mercy, mercy me. Biscuits. Yeah, push on. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. sweet Caesar, what a break. Shut up, boy. You know they don't pass no chitlins around in here. Bixby! Boy, go out of here. You in the Waldorf. Yeah, I know you know me when, but forget it. Right now, yeah.
I wish everybody could have had that much fun in the recording studio. You know, I mean, it was an intimidating thing back then in a lot of ways because people weren't used to it. So to be able to walk in and just be that cool and relaxed and be able to be yourself and just knock off takes like that, phenomenal what he was capable of doing. And also, keep this in mind now, too. I mean, we really didn't cover a huge frame of time, and we've moved from this really almost old-fashioned, old-school version of piano playing that is just moderately a little bit beyond what ragtime is. Mm-hmm. And now we're already into almost like jump and jive ground. This is like, you know, making suggestions of where people like Louis Jordan would be taking the music. This is the connection, and that's kind of like, well, in fact, let's...
And if he's only just putting musicians together... like days before, they're not even like really doing very many run-throughs before they put these tracks down.
Well, at this point, that band, his rhythm, you know, Fats Waller and his rhythm, a lot of those guys were with them for a lot. They were lifers at this point.
All right.
There were a couple of guys that would change, but like the guitar player, Al Casey, and some of the horn players, they were there. The guitar player, I think I said that already, were there for quite a while. But... just the way that he would write it. Here's another example, basically, of another song, which is basically, you know, self-explanatory. Cold, the joint is jumping. And again, it's just full of his spirit and his energy. And you can see how he is more or less taking jazz and pushing it almost inevitably toward what would eventually be rock and roll, and really, in a way. But at this instance, I would say he's pushing it toward that, like I said, that unique bridge, which would have been, say, Louis Jordan. Mm-hmm. Check it out on this track, The Joint is Jumping.
They have a new expression along old Harlem Way that tells you when a party is 10 times more than gay. To say that things are jumping leaves not a single doubt that everything is in full swing when you hear someone shout. It is, the joint is jumping. It's really jumping. Come in, cats, and check your hats. I mean, this joint is jumping. The piano's thumping. The dancers are bumping. This here spot is more than hot. In fact, the joint is jumping. Check your weapons at the door. Be sure to pay your quarter. Burn your leather on the floor. Grab anybody's daughter. The roof is rocking. The neighbor's knocking. We're all bums when the wagon comes. I mean, the joint is jumping. Let it be. Yeah. Send this joint, boy. Yeah. Oh, my, yeah. Don't you hit that chick. That's my broad. Where'd you get that stuff at? Well, I'll knock you to your knees. What? Put this cat out of here. What? Get rid of that pistol. Get rid of that pistol. Yeah. Get rid of it. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Oh, man, it's really ready. No, baby, not now. I can't come over there right now. Yes, it's a woman.
started jumping. It's really jumping. Every Moses on his toes, I mean, this joint is jumping. Uh-huh, no time for talking. This place is walking, yeah. Hit the jug and cut the rug. I said the joint is jumping. Listen, get your pig feet bare and gin. There's plenty in the kitchen. Who is that that just came in? Just look at the way he's switching. Oh, my goodness. Don't mind the hour. I'm in power. I got bail if we go to jail. I said the joint is jumping. Don't give your right name. No, no, no.
See, you always saying he says, yes, yes, but there he says, no, no.
He switched it up on me.
Let me remind you that you are listening to the Friday edition of American at Radio. We call our show How Music Changed, and this is part 15, which we are operating under the title of Piano from Blues to Boogie to Big Band, featuring especially the music of Fats Waller. This is our second show in this series. And if you're interested in what we're doing, if you want to catch up on some of our history now, we've got a lot of these under our belt now. Older shows, a good number of these now, which are very historic shows. If you're interested in hearing them, you can go to our website. And we've also got some more, you know, contemporary shows as well, of course, all on our website. Just search for American Hit Radio, and our site will come right up if you click on whatever you get on your search engine. And you'll see right there on the homepage, our Wednesday show is on the left. This show, the Friday show, is on the right-hand side. The most recent shows are right there on the homepage. You can, there's a simple little button that says click to see more if you want to see what else is there. And there are literally hundreds and hundreds of shows to choose from. We've been saving them all and putting them all up on the internet. And this series in particular, I'm very proud of it. I think that they're worth hearing from actually in some semblance of an order, because there's some sense of continuity here, believe it or not. Now that I've been doing this for 4 years, it's I'm beginning to see, oh, this falls into place somehow. It begins to make sense. So check it out if you like. That's How Music Changed series on the internet. Just search for American Hit Radio and it should come right up. All right then, as we're covering the music of Fats Waller today in our look at piano and its development through early jazz, and as it worked its way up, we are now at the point where we want to play something a little bit more mellow, a little bit more heartfelt by Mr. Fats Waller. I had mentioned that he had had marital problems. He did get remarried to a woman named Anita, who was, for him, everything that his first wife wasn't. She was pretty much his mainstay, his support, his lifeblood, the person who was actually willing to put up with his insanity and deal with it. Gave him sons. Loved it, you know, just became a bit of a family man with Anita. So he actually wrote this song dedicated to the wife who he had loved so much. The song is simply entitled Anita.
Bound to come true. Gray skies will change into blue. Your eyes will help see me through. It's not a great big task. Your love is all I ask.
my whole life was wasted. Till your sweet lips I tasted, I know now, repeat now, I love you, Anita, I do.
Called Anita by Fats Waller. Well, I've heard, this hour went by so quickly.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking you wanted to dedicate that song to me.
Yeah, I wish I could write. I wish I had the talent and the ability. Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much, Heidi. Therefore, I will. Not the same when you bring it up for yourself, though, is it?
No. Sorry about that. And especially when you almost call me by your ex-wife's name.
No, I did not.
I'm kidding.
Oh, man. All right, then we're going to get room for one more. This has been so quick. But I will be back next week with a little bit more from Fats Waller, and we will be moving on also with our look at jazz piano and its development through the big band era and some of the people who basically pushed it along. And let's see. That brings one more song written by Fats, which I think is a rather funny song. I hear this song as probably something that he had written about a guy who was maybe even bigger than he was. And he's looking at him, and he said, I'm going to write a song about that guy. He's pretty big. It's called All That Meat and No Potatoes.
Oh!
Take care, everybody. See you next week, everyone.
Like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating, with all that meat and no potatoes. All that meat and no potatoes. All that food to the alligators, yeah. Hold me steady, I am ready, with all that meat and no potatoes. I don't think that peas are bad. With me, most anything goes. I look in the pot, I'm fit to fight. Cause woman, you know that mess ain't right. All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yes, I'm steaming, I'm really screaming. All that meat and no potatoes.
Where's my fine hamburger? Where is it?